From the offices of Cocktail Collective, this is Cocktails Distilled, a podcast that takes your favourite spirits and liqueurs from the still to the cocktail glass. In each episode, we talk to distillers and creators about particular expressions that their brand have released, what they are, why they were created, and in what cocktails they can be used. Are you ready to understand what's in your glass, or perhaps should be? Welcome to Cocktails Distilled. There's nothing as quintessentially American as bourbon, and its manufacture is a practice that goes back to the late 1700s. It is steeped in tradition, it has rules for production, and it also has, to purists at least, its very own home state, Kentucky. But back in 1997, a new brand, Jefferson's Bourbon, started up and became a disruptor in the space. We talked to Jefferson Bourbon's founder, Trey Zoller, about innovation, aging, and what it means to seek balance in the blend. Thanks for joining us, Trey.
You bet. Thanks for having me on.
Now, you named Jefferson's after the third U.S. president, who was known for his independence and desire for freedom. Was it always your intention to disrupt the industry?
No, it really wasn't in the beginning. It turns out that we have been known for our innovations, and obviously Thomas Jefferson was a great innovator. However, really, when I started, bourbon was in a 30-year decline, and the thousands of distilleries that were around prior to Prohibition had been whittled down to just eight in the state of Kentucky. And all of those eight distilleries heralded their heritage and tradition. And I was in my late 20s when I started this up, so I thought I needed a little bit of heritage and tradition. And I thought what we were putting in the bottle at the time was very complex and very sophisticated. And I thought that Thomas Jefferson kind of embodied all of that. So it was really just a name that would kind of give an indication of what we were putting into the bottle. It wasn't until later that I started playing around with it that we got more of our innovative nature.
Now, can I ask, if bourbon was in a little bit of decline, what made you think to start it?
I was too dumb to know better.
Right.
That's really what it was. Growing up in Kentucky, bourbon is everywhere. If you went to my grandmother's house, she didn't ask you what you want to drink. She would ask you, how do you take your bourbon? Everything that she cooked with was smothered in bourbon. Right. My eighth-generation grandmother was arrested for moonshining and bootlegging. So it was just all around you. It wasn't until I moved away, and I moved to about a half dozen different places around the U.S. and found that I couldn't find bourbon as readily as I did in Kentucky. Actually, there was very little bourbon to be found at all. I'd find Jim Beam, Wild Turkey, maybe Maker's Mark if I was lucky. And then I would come home for the holidays and drive past all these warehouses that I knew were full of great old bourbons that were either evaporating off into nothing or being blended into a four-year-old bourbon, so they weren't able to be showcased. So I thought that there was great opportunity, specifically because there was great momentum with single malt scotches at the time. And I thought we had a much better product. So I thought it was just a matter of purchasing these barrels, buying them, buying the barrels, putting them in bottles and taking them out and exposing it to people around the country to let them taste for themselves, which when I started, there wasn't much interest in it. So that's really how it kind of evolved.
Must have been difficult to get it off the ground then, if it was difficult to actually sell it.
It was. I would take it to friends of mine parties around the country. And, at the time, it would be the last thing that was opened up. Now,
really,
with things have changed so dramatically that it's the first thing finished when you go to a party. So bourbon is really, it was kind of thought of as the, redheaded stepchild, so to speak, of the spirits category back in the early 90s. It wasn't until early to mid 2005 to 2010 that things really started to change. And that's when people, and it's kind of, we're looking at it right now with disruption that's going on right now. And back in 2008, when we had such a housing crisis here and the economy really got wrecked, people started going back and looking for value. And they found that with bourbon. And then they found, once they dug into it, that they were, it was seeped in heritage and tradition and stories. And there was a lot to it. And people could really kind of geek out and share stories about it. And they dug more into it. Really, I think more so than anything, it was the access to information via smartphones that gave people this information that they could share. And they loved to sit down with a small group of friends and share that.
Now, how difficult was it to actually walk into an industry that is so steeped in tradition? How difficult was it to be a startup?
It was difficult. As I said, there were 8 distilleries making all the bourbon back then, and 2 of them sued me, or threatened to sue me right out of the gate. They didn't want the competition. And, there wasn't much of a consumer at the time. The consumer that was there were typically older men. And they were dying off. They weren't replenishing themselves. And those older men were typically drawn to one specific brand. My great uncle is a perfect example. I give him all the Jefferson's Reserve he wanted to drink, but he was quite happy to sit and drink his Jack Daniels, as he would say. I like my Jack Daniels. This is my drink. And things have changed dramatically. Now, people aren't married to one brand, so to speak. They're much more promiscuous in the category. People don't have just one bourbon on their back bar. They typically have many, which has really been a great advantage to us because people are willing to try. And the more that they were willing to try, the more we were willing to experiment and kind of try to push the boundaries of what bourbon is without bastardizing it. And the more that we came out with successful products, they liked the taste of it, the more they wanted to see us try.
Now, you use the expression alchemy is everything on your website. Do you want to explain what you mean by that?
Yeah. I'm not a distiller. We have some great distillers that make a very great product. We continue to contract from big distillers as well. We've had contracts with some of the big distilleries for 20 years, and we use that great base. And then really that's the science of it. And you've got to have that great science for the distillate. And once you have that base, then you can play around with it kind of more of an art form with the maturation and the blending. So it's really a combination to break these things down into different segments and really look at it as kind of a science and an art, to really come up with something unique. When I started, buying from a number of distillers across the state, they would all tell me the same thing. 60 to 75% of what bourbon is, or the heart and soul of bourbon, comes from the maturation process. And yet everybody was maturing it the same way. And as I looked, and I benefit from my dad being a bourbon historian, and he identified over 2,500 distilleries in Kentucky alone prior to Prohibition, but the recipes were almost all the same. So if you look at that and say, all right, there's really room to kind of expand what bourbon can be with the maturation. And that's where I wanted to really put my emphasis and look at it more from a smaller kind of alchemy lens.
And I suppose that ties in with the fact that you're known for your small batches.
Correct. We actually call them ridiculously small batches, about 12 barrels for some of our bottlings. It's enough. It's a great combination of the benefits of a single barrel and an extremely small batch. There are some great honey barrels that have some wonderful flavors. And if you like barrel 8 from a single bottling, you might try the barrel number 9, and it might be very, very different than 8. They could be both great, but you don't have that consistency. We're doing a ridiculously small batch. We're able to get these better barrels and then also bring in enough of them to where you do have a consistent flavor profile.
And I suppose it's all coming down to the skill of the blender.
It is. It's still, we've got so many different products, but it's still the most fun for me to put together our Jefferson's Very Small Batch and our Jefferson's Reserve because each batch, it's a blending practice. And it's not like once you get the process down that you're just doing it over and over. Each time you've got to sit down, taste next to the control, and try to bring these four different bourbons together and have a very consistent flavor, yet try to optimize each batch so they're the best they can be.
Blending or discussion of blending isn't really typical within bourbon.
Right. Bourbons weren't really discussed, or blending technique. And how I came to kind of be a blender is kind of from default. I started buying from these larger producers. And again, they had an ocean of old bourbon because they were in a 30-year decline, which just built up inventory. So I would get a call at the end of every fiscal quarter or year saying, Trey, I've got 400 barrels of a 17-year-old, 300 barrels of a 14-year-old. Are you interested? Right. And I started accumulating these small esoteric lots of bourbon. And I found by bringing them together that the whole was better than the parts. So what we're working with is all Kentucky straight bourbon whiskey. So it's all very pure. But by blending it, I feel like I can get more flavor throughout the tasting experience. I try to get it to be more complex and bring it up front, mid palate, and then the finish, equally amounts of flavor. So it's not just dominated with one flavor or one part of the tasting experience is where most of the flavor comes. So it's about kind of balance and complexity.
So in an interesting way, it's very similar to what a bartender is trying to do.
It absolutely is. It's about that balance. And that was really demonstrated to me when I was working with a number of mixologists when we put together our barrel-aged Manhattan. And I did that in conjunction with Esquire magazine. And everything that I would send up to them was very bourbon-forward, which I liked. However, they really showed me the art of letting all the other components do their work and balance it out. So it is, in essence, it's very similar to what bartenders are trying to do.
Now, your products are divided into three types: foundation, innovation, and cask finishes. Do you want to explain a little bit about each one?
Sure. The foundation is kind of what we just talked about. It's about the blending, our Jefferson and Jefferson's Reserve. Now we have 19 different expressions of Jefferson's, and 17 of those 19, we're doing something different than what most distillers are doing, which is distilling it, aged, cutting to proof, and bottling it. So we're not trying to cheat the process or accelerate the process because we're always using fully mature bourbon whiskey. But once we've got that foundation, we want to see what else we can do to push the boundaries, to put more time, money, and effort into it to massage the juice one way or the other. And so, as you said, with the foundation, we're doing that through blending exercises. Through innovation, we've done things like our Jefferson's Ocean, where we change the environment, agitation of the aging, or we work with different, kind of like our chef's collaboration, where we brought bourbon and rye together to create a pairing spirit. And then we also have our finishes that you mentioned that we've done Napa Cabernets and Cabernets from Bordeaux, where we take fully mature Kentucky straight bourbon whiskey and finish it in freshly dumped wine barrels or rum barrels or soon to be cognac barrels. And we'll age that depending on what the barrels are from anywhere from 4 to 15 months to get those flavors from what those barrels carried previously to come out and really work with the bourbon. And when we do that, we put them in what I call hot boxes, which are nothing more than shipping containers. So when it's extremely hot and humid here in Kentucky, that's just amplified being in those hot boxes. And that sweats out what was ever in those barrels previously into the bourbon. And then the longer those barrels in the hot box, the more those molecules come together and really balance out the bourbon.
With that sort of heat, though, you must be losing quite a bit to Angel's Share, though.
We do. We do. You know, we do top off the barrels when we fill those up. But, you know, usually we lose 7 to 8% the first year in Kentucky.
That's quite high.
That is quite high. And Trust me, that's just, we're losing a lot more than that when we put it into the hot boxes.
I can imagine. You mentioned that you had 19 different expressions. With that number, how should somebody approach the range?
Well, we've kind of got a core range, which is our Jeffersons, which is kind of our entry-level product. But again, that's all about balance, which is U.S. about $34 a bottle. And then our most quintessential bourbon-flavored product would be our Jefferson's Reserve. I think that just brings out so many great bourbon flavors. So those are great places, either one of those, to start. And then it's kind of like I use those as a control almost to taste next to some of the other things that we've done. And it really depends what you like. I ask people typically when they ask me what, you know, which bourbon I should pour them, you know, if they're wine drinkers, I say, got to try our Pritchard Hill Cabernet Cask finish. It's got a great black cherry flavor that comes out of it. It's, if you like big Cabernets, you'll love this bourbon. For somebody that likes a Scotch, I usually point them in direction of our Jefferson's Ocean because of the saltiness that comes out of it. A lot of people think it tastes like salted caramel popcorn. So it is a range. And once people get in, they can experiment out and get a good idea of what they like and then what they think they would like based on what we're either finishing it or how we're changing the aging process.
A lot of your innovation bourbons have been produced through collaborations. The main one, of course, is Jefferson's Ocean, which you've mentioned. Do you want to talk a little bit about how that came about?
You bet. You bet. It was actually a lot of fun. I got to collaborate, and this is how a lot of the innovations come about. I don't really realize that I'm collaborating with someone until we've kind of backed into an idea of creating a product. I happened to be on a friend of mine's ship, which was named the Ocean at the time. It is now called O-Search, combining ocean and research, because he catches, tags, and releases great white sharks to collect their data to kind of follow the top predator down, like you would the lion in the Serengeti, in order to work on abundance and sustainability of our oceans. So I spent some time with him down in Costa Rica for one at birthdays at the same time. We caught sharks and surfed and drank a lot of bourbon. And as we were drinking bourbon on the bow of the ship, I saw the rocket back and forth within the bottle. Now, if I thought that bourbon rocked back and forth within the bottle, it certainly would in a barrel, and that would change the maturation. So I suggested to him, let's put some barrels on the ship. And he suggested that's probably not such a good idea, as his crew catches great white sharks. So the more he drank, the more he came up with a great idea. Let's put some barrels on the ship.
Right.
And we did that, and it was kind of a dual good idea. We were also doing it, and we were going to sell that and support his cause with it, with the proceeds of it. That's what we're doing today. So we put the barrels on the ship. There's constant contact with the wood as it's rocking back and forth. Today, each voyage crosses the equator four times, so that extreme heat caramelizes the sugars in them. And then the barrels, you know, as we lose a lot to evaporation, they also breathe in the salt air, so they absorb this briny taste. So as I said, people say it tastes like salted caramel popcorn.
One thing that I'm curious about, I mean, look, as any sailor will tell you, no two voyages are the same. Whiskey, when it comes back, must always be relatively inconsistent. So how do you bring it to a point of consistency, or do you not?
Well, we have some consistent factors, but you're absolutely right. There are no two voyages are the same. And even though our voyages go on the same route, which is to 30 ports on five continents, as I said, crossing the equator four times, depending on the time of year or what it encounters, makes a big difference on what the end result is of the bourbon. For instance, I think it was voyage 14, and we get daily sea conditions, whether it's calm, moderate, rough, or very rough, and sea and air temperatures. So we're able to kind of figure out what's been going on. But voyage 14 got hit by three different hurricanes and just got rocked to death.
Yeah.
And that extreme rocking made for an abnormally large amount of angel share. We lost well over 50% of the yield due to the evaporation, which wasn't good for us. However, it was good for the bourbon. You know, some people love Voyage 14 because it was so condensed and so abnormally high, and there was a high abundance of the brininess that came through that made it very unique. So you're absolutely right. Even though we've done 20 plus voyages of the ocean, no two are the same. And we now have three different types of voyage. We do our regular voyage, which has a small grain of rye, our cask strength voyage, which is also rye, that we're just about to bottle up right now. And that'll come out, I believe, at 112 proof this voyage. And then we also do a wheated voyage, which small grain being wheat, does not try to compete with some of those flavors that the ocean's known for. So it's even more briny and more of a caramel flavor than you would see in just a typical ocean.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you'd done some collaborations with the chef, for example. Could you talk us through some of the other innovative products that you've produced?
You bet. Chef that I collaborated with, Chef Edward Lee, we created the first pairing spirit with our Jefferson Chefs collaboration. He asked me to do a bourbon pairing for a dinner that he was cooking for his cookbook launch. And when I did, I sat next to the editor-in-chief of Esquire magazine, and we developed the Jefferson's Esquire Barrel Aged Manhattan. I've had the great fortune of collaborating with Cyril Chapelet, who owns Chapelet Winery, with our Jefferson's Pritchard Hill Cabernet Cask finish, which he's been prince of a man to work with and loves the collaboration. I collaborated with some of the great chateaus of Bordeaux that Thomas Jefferson visited, wrote about, served at the White House, and then served at his house, Monticello. That was Chateau Pichon-Baron and Chateau Soutereau. So, been a great opportunity to work with great properties and great people that helped me understand bourbon, helps me see the forest through the trees, because they're experts in other areas and they don't have the same blinders on that I do, or think that there's the same parameters that you have to stay with it.
Sounds like you've had a fair amount of fun with what you've been creating.
That's key. That's one thing that I'm lucky enough now with some great people to tie it into fun and been able to be on some great ships with folks and rides and visit some of the great wineries around the world to work with them. So it's been a whole lot of fun.
Now, you've recently been acquired by Pernod Ricard. How has that changed the way that you operate?
It's too soon to tell what they have reiterated to me that they want to keep it very entrepreneurial and innovative, and they just want to give me the resources and the power of the Pernod Ricard machine behind it to help bring some of the innovations that we developed to market and make it more of a global brand, which is kind of my goal, which I've had for some time now, is to make Jefferson's a very top-notch, respected global brand, but still do it in the fashion that I would like to and not have it become more generic by being with a larger company. So thus far, it's been great having that support, having the ability to look at things at more of a global scale is exciting, and I think it's going to present a lot of opportunity.
How do you match up being available on a global scale with being small batch?
Well, it's a lot more work. So as we grow, we've got to produce a lot more more batches. And so that just takes more time to put them together. I'm very hands-on with each and every batch. So I do have a couple other people that we taste together. So, but we're going to maintain that. It's something that is very important. Our quality controls are more efficient now, and we're able to have some better checks and balances. So I think that's going to help as well.
I'm sure you're a bit of a purist who believes that bourbon should only ever be drunk straight. But if you were to put it in a cocktail, mention the barrel-aged Manhattan, but what other drinks would you recommend?
So I am a purist, and actually I probably drink more bourbon on the rocks than I do neat.
Okay.
Which I've had bartenders tell me they won't serve me like a Jefferson's Ocean on the rocks. It's too good to drink that way. But it's kind of how I grew up drinking it and still do. I love it. A good old-fashioned. I like Sazeracs. I like Manhattans. But mainly, if I'm going to have a bourbon cocktail, I like to put in just a little Luxardo cherry juice and a Luxardo cherry.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty simple cocktail, but really enjoy that. And also, with so many different expressions of Jefferson's, it's almost like I'm having a different cocktail with each expression, because there are such vastly different flavors. It was kind of a shining light on me one time when I had somebody tell me that he tried our Jefferson's Pritchard Hill cast finish for the first time and absolutely hated it. And now it's his favorite bourbon. And the reason he told me he hated it, he said, "Trey, I hated it because I did not expect those flavors. And it wasn't what my preconceived notion was that bourbon should be." But then I went back to it, and I found that I actually love those flavors. It just wasn't what I was expecting. And then he said further, it's kind of like when you have a drink of lemonade, but it's not lemonade. It's a Sprite. When you drink it, you don't see it, and you're expecting one thing, and you get a different flavor, it completely throws you off. And that made me really think about that and say, that's right. You know, I'm working with these all the time, and I'm expecting different flavors to come out because of what we're doing with aging. We are pushing kind of boundaries of what bourbon can taste like. Not everybody's going to expect that.
Now, on that point, what has the general reaction from the bourbon community been to the sort of experimentation-based products you're producing?
Well, I think initially it wasn't so well received. I think it wasn't something. I listened to the people that I saw say, "Oh, that's not traditional bourbon. That's not how it's made." You know, when we first came out with Jefferson's Ocean, that's what I heard. That's not how bourbon's matured. That's not right. And we've since done a Jefferson's Journey. The reason that bourbon proliferated in Kentucky, bourbon can be made and is made in every state today. But why it proliferated in Kentucky? Most people would say it's our limestone water or it's our ever-changing climate. But really what it was after there was the first tax in the U.S., the whiskey tax, and then there was a whiskey rebellion, and distillers went over the Appalachian Mountains or passed the long arm of the tax man. When they distilled in Kentucky, the way to get it to market was to put it on boats and float it down the rivers of America down to New Orleans, and then put it on ships and sail around on the tip of Florida and back to where there were people, which was New York and Boston and Philadelphia. And prior to that, people were drinking whiskey right off the still, so it was clear like vodka or gin. It wasn't until that whiskey made the journey that it transformed into bourbon for the first time.
So it's basically doing what you're doing with Ocean then.
Exactly. Exactly. So in essence, we're going back to how it was originally done in the first place. And I thought it was kind of ironic that a lot of traditionalists thought we weren't doing the right thing, but it was really the one thing that was done exactly as bourbon gained fame and really started to become America's spirit was because of that journey. And today the consumer is much more educated. The consumer, you know, there's still that traditionalist and there's plenty of bourbons for them. The only difference is age and proof. But there are a lot of people out there right now that want to see what else you can do. How else can we make this stand out? make it a little bit different. And as long as you're doing it with a great base of bourbon, you're not trying to sneak out young whiskey, then I think, you know, there's some that people are going to like better than others, or some that people might not like, but they're going to respect it as long as you're using a great base to start with.
I imagine that experimentation actually brings a lot of new people to the category as well.
I think so. It does. And the Pritchard Hill Cabernet Fetish is a perfect example. Oh, no, no, I don't like bourbon. I just, you know, I'm a wine drinker. Oh, really? Mm. Try this. Oh, wow. I didn't think a bourbon could taste like this. This is beautiful. We've got a rum cask fetish where we age bourbon in 20-year-old rum barrels. And you get a great banana and coconut flavor that comes out. It tastes like a dessert bourbon. And
wow.
People,
okay.
Some people, you know, just never thought that that's what a bourbon could taste like.
Now, what's next in terms of experimentation for Jefferson's?
We've got a lot of experiments coming up. Yeah, I've been working with Independent State Company, which is the largest cooperage, for years. And then over the last 8 years, after I became a barrel chef back in 2012 for a couple days for them, I saw how rudimentary we were with bourbon barrels by only putting a char on them and what other techniques there were out there that were being implemented in wine casks or other spirits casks from around. So I've done a lot of experiments with that. We created our own proprietary barrel, which was extra seasoned. It was grooved out inside, so it would have twice as much surface area. We put a flash jar on there and then toasted it to bring out mocha flavors. And we finished some older bourbon in that, and we're putting some young bourbon in there as well now. So we'll age that for, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years. So I think there's a lot on the forefront. We've got lots of experiments that we're ready to put out. We're bringing back rye whiskey into our portfolio that we haven't had in the last 5 years. And we're doing some pretty innovative things with that that I'm really excited about.
It sounds like the future for Jefferson's is going to be really quite exciting. And the people should stay tuned.
You got it.
Now, obviously, you would be available in every state in the U.S. Where else are you available globally?
We've got some down in Australia, Japan, Hong Kong, a little bit in the U.K., France. So not too many markets. We're building up stocks, and a year from July is when we're trying to really bring more of a export and global presence.
And if people want more information, they can obviously go to your website, which is jeffersonsbourbon.com.
You got it. You got it.
Thank you so much, Trey, for taking the time to speak to us today.
You got it. Thanks. I love the questions. This is a lot of fun. It's great to get the word out, and hopefully more and more people can discover what different bourbons are all about.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And we'd like to thank you for listening to this episode of Cocktails Distilled. Be sure to visit cocktailcollective.com.au to access the show notes. And if you like what you've heard, we'd love you to subscribe, rate, and give a review on iTunes. Until next time, cheers.